At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
At more than 4,000 pages and coming in just under the deadline, there's a lot to unpack in the latest spending bill. So we may as well dig in. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdal. It's Tuesday, December the 27th. Good to have you with us. In the coming days, President Biden is expected to sign off on $1.7 trillion in government spending. The omnibus bill funds everything from aid to Ukraine to opioid use disorder treatment programs. And it includes a provision that tribal nations have been pushing for decades, $5 billion in what are called advance appropriations for the Federal Indian Health Service. The IHS provides health care to around 2.5 million American Indians and Alaska Natives. And in the past, its annual budget had to be reapproved every year, leaving the agency in bad shape during federal budget impasses and government shutdowns. Marketplace's Savannah Marr reports on what this shift to advance funding will mean.
There's sort of a dark joke in Indian country that if you're going to get sick, you better do it before summer. Chief Kirk Francis of the Penobscot Indian Nation in Maine says that's about when IHS-funded clinics and hospitals start running low on cash.
You might get to June or July and realize you don't have the resources
to order expensive imaging or refer patients to specialists. But it's during government shutdowns when they really start rationing care. During the 34-day impasse in 2019,
we had a person that was complaining of symptoms and was unable to get into the appropriate care.
Until it was an emergency.
And then they found out that it was a cardiac problem.
A lack of advance funding has also gotten in the way of basic planning at IHS-funded facilities, says Jessica Farb, who looked into this for the Government Accountability Office.
They don't know what investments they can make, when they can make those investments, how much money they can set aside.
For things like staffing and infrastructure improvements. That means the IHS is reacting to emergencies rather than preparing for them, says Glenn Wilson, COO of American Indian Health and Family Services in Detroit.
And a great example of that would be the COVID pandemic,
which has killed Indigenous Americans at a higher rate than any other group.
If advance appropriations would have been in place, we would have had a lot more money to initially attend to some things.
Chief Francis says a properly funded IHS isn't a favor to tribal nations. It's owed to them, based on the federal government's trust and treaty obligations.
Advanced appropriations is the first step in really starting to change the conversation from a discretionary conversation to a mandatory one.
Only the first step, because even with advance appropriations, Francis says the IHS is massively underfunded, to the tune of over $45 billion by tribal leaders' latest estimation. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
The omnibus spending bill also includes a bundle of reforms to federal retirement savings programs. That bundle, of course, has a long name with a short but clever acronym. The Setting Every Community Up for Retirement Enhancement, or SECURE Act 2.0. It builds on 2019 legislation and is supposed to make it easier to save for your later years. The act includes several provisions that could chip away at one of the biggest disparities in retirement savings, the gender gap. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more.
Saving for retirement is harder for women because they generally earn less over their lifetime, says Betsy Stevenson, an economist at the University of Michigan.
For a large number of reasons. Discrimination's obviously up there, but so are all sorts of forms of inequality in terms of the occupations that tend to attract women and family obligations.
She says women often have more employment gaps and gravitate to flexible work. The new legislation will make it easier for part-time workers to participate in employer-based retirement plans. And it creates a novel program to allow employers to match a percentage of an employee's student loan payments as if they were retirement contributions.
60% of our college students are women, and women have a lot more student loans than men do.
Women also live longer than men, notes Mark Ivory at the Brookings Institution.
Women have a greater need for protected, predictable, monthly lifetime retirement income that they can never outlive.
The bill makes it easier to enroll in annuities, insurance add-ons for 401ks that guarantee income for life, almost like a pension. It also adds federal funding to match low-income workers' retirement contributions and requires employer-sponsored plans to automatically enroll new employees. Shai Akabas of the Bipartisan Policy Center says that could particularly benefit women of color, whose wages lag even further behind white men.
When automatic enrollment is used, participation goes up dramatically for all workers, but especially for low and moderate income workers and workers of color.
Still, he says, more could be done for the nearly 50% of workers whose employers don't offer a retirement plan. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
More than a million American households spent the holidays without power as extreme, bitterly cold weather gripped much of the country. Most people have their power back now, but the widespread outages were the latest evidence of the fragility of the U.S. power grid. Marketplace's Lily Jamali has more on what's being done to shore up the grid and ensure the lights stay on for everyone.
With each passing year, the electrical grid that delivers our power gets a little more vulnerable, says Trevor Kerwin, director of strategic partnerships at automotive consumer company Shiva.ai.
Increasingly, the hardware that we use to deliver it, the wires, the substations, all of that is getting a little run down.
Kerwin says some utilities haven't done enough to maintain their aging systems. And now climate change is making extreme weather events and impacts on the grid worse.
We need a massive maintenance project around the power grid to increase resiliency as there's more storms and the storms are harsher.
Many utilities underestimated the amount of demand for electricity there would be over the holidays, and some power plants failed to operate, says Simon Mahan, executive director of the Southern Renewable Energy Association. He says to minimize future blackouts, the country needs more transmission lines to move power from where it's being generated to where it's needed.
If you're not able to send enough megawatts from one region to another, then it's sort of like you're pinching a straw and not allowing enough flow from one to the next.
Last month, the Biden administration announced $13 billion in funding to harden the nation's power grid against extreme weather and climate change, and to build new transmission lines. Demand on the grid is expected to grow with the push to decarbonize, says Peter Fox Penner of Energy Impact Partners.
That is changing how the system has to be designed and operated and built.
Another critical need, he says, is building more local power storage to make the grid cleaner and more resilient. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, some big names had a bad day. We'll have the details when we do the numbers.
Many parts of this economy struggled this year, with demand outpacing supply. One of the most critical shortages was infant formula. A key plant closure last February, along with other supply chain problems, meant that in May, over 43% of formula products nationwide were out of stock. Formula, of course, is incredibly important for many families. An analysis by the Kaiser Family Foundation found that by the time they were 3 months old, over half of the infants born in 2018 received formula. We're now 7 months out from that spring shortage and checking in on whether things have improved. Marielle Padilla is a reporter for The 19th. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We heard about this baby formula shortage back in May when it seemed to be kind of at its worst. How are things going now?
So things are looking a lot better than they were looking in May. I mean, as of the end of November, we're near the same levels of in stock that we were pre-shortage. We're about 12.5% of formula baby powder out of stock, which is about where we were in January. But that being said, there's still a lot of mothers and families reporting having a hard time finding what they need. And I talked to experts about this, and this is because the shortage is looking more hyper-localized. So there are certain stores at certain times in certain areas that will just be out of stock still. So it's still not all the way back.
So even though a lot of formula is still available, there are still some kinds that are really hard to get, especially for certain communities. Can you explain that?
Communities that are in rural areas or lower income families that rely on the WIC program sometimes have a hard time finding specialty formulas. These are formulas that are made for people with specific allergies or sensitive digestion or specific nutritional needs. And when one store doesn't have that, sometimes these families are required to drive 20, 30 miles away to try another store. And if that store doesn't have it, they just have to continue this search. So even though it looks like these stores are stocked, it's still a shortage in practice for many families.
In your article, you mentioned that low-income families, specifically women of color, more often rely on formula to feed their children. So how has this shortage affected them in particular?
So more than 80% of infants consume formula at some point in the first year of their lives. And so I think that's important to know first. But then low-income parents, particularly women of color, rely on formula to feed their babies at higher rates because of, you know, their job situations, less flexibility, less parental leave, less opportunity to breastfeed on the job, those types of things. So women of color continue to be most impacted by the shortage.
What needs to happen to sort of eliminate the remaining shortage?
Right. Well, in the short term, the government did a lot of things that most of the experts agreed were great short-term fixes, things like importing formula from other countries, revisiting regulation guidelines to help other competitors enter, looking into the current system and reevaluating how many manufacturing companies there are domestically, things like that. But in the long term, I think it's going to be all about expanding the playing field and making it easier for more competition to enter the industry.
What resources are available for parents who are still having trouble finding formula for their babies?
So the WIC program, like I mentioned, there are local WIC clinics all over the country that provide support and resources, educational materials on what practices to avoid to keep infants safe. These types of local clinics are where I would encourage any mother struggling to go for help, and then they would have more localized resources and advice there.
Marielle Padilla is a reporter for The 19th News. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
coming up.
So this is where the magic happens.
The magic of science. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 37 points, a tenth of a percent, to close at 33,241. The NASDAQ shed 144 points, 1.3%, to end at 10,353. The S&P 500 was off 15 points, 0.4%, to finish at 3829. Tesla slowed more than 11% after the company announced an extended production pause. Southwest Airlines fell almost 6%. The company has canceled more than 70% of its scheduled flights and says major disruptions could continue for the next several days as severe winter weather buffets many parts of the country. The S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller National Home Price Index showed the average home price went up 9.2% year-over-year in October, down from 10.7% in September. Bond prices fell, the yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.85%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Ascensus, helping people dream bigger, aim higher, and save more with financial confidence. Unleash the power of your retirement savings plan with innovative technology that makes things easy, top-notch service from experts who care, and flexible solutions that can grow with you. For more than 40 years, Ascensus has been helping savers achieve their goals. We can help you achieve yours, too. Learn more at Ascensus.com. That's Ascensus.com.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. Self-driving vehicle technology is still in its infancy, but the technology has been piloted in a number of cities. Now, a university in North Carolina says it's working on plans to use self-driving shuttles to transport students. Cole Del Charco visited the campus in Greensboro to find out more.
It all started with an idea for a senior design project.
I woke up one day and I was like, yeah, I kind of want to do a small-scale RC car.
RC is in remote control. At the time, Daniel Tobias was an undergraduate at North Carolina Agricultural and Technical State University, one of the historically Black colleges and universities in North Carolina. Tobias was getting bored writing papers at the lab he worked in. So, for the project, he convinced his research director to let him make a remote-controlled car one-tenth the size of an average car. After graduating, he moved to Detroit to work in the auto industry with Fiat Chrysler. Now, he's back as a graduate student studying data science at NCA&T.
It's been a very rewarding, I would say, career path. You get involved in the mechanical aspects, electrical and computer science.
And now, on campus at his alma mater, Tobias is working on an autonomous shuttle for students. I'm speaking with him beside a 2-mile rural autonomous vehicle test track. It's part of the school's autonomous vehicle lab. Professor Ali Karamadini leads the research and helped Tobias with that first project. In one half of the lab, there's a whiteboard, desks, and computers. In the other half, six autonomous vehicles.
Low-speed vehicles for, let's say, campus, downtown, and so on. We also have higher-speed vehicles that are more appropriate for longer distance travel, let's say highways and some other areas.
Kara Medini and the team are analyzing data from one of many test runs. The goal is to build shuttles that will transport students, but also serve as a model for communities.
Our focus is in public transportation and the way that we can develop autonomous vehicle technology for public transportation.
In the fall, they're hoping to launch 4 6-passenger vehicles to take students around campus and downtown. The team is working with the city of Greensboro, along with the North Carolina Department of Transportation and others, to test whether this kind of project is feasible. It's one of many similar plans in the works across the U.S.
There are a number of states that are developing executive orders or even legalizing deployment of automated vehicles, kind of creating that sort of incentive.
Frank Dalma co-authored a study analyzing all of those plans. He researches transportation at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School of Public Affairs. Dalma says autonomous vehicles could improve or harm social equity for disadvantaged groups. He sees two possible futures, one where AVs create a stronger transit system for all, or another where private vehicles make getting around more difficult.
Developing policies to address specific inequities or underserved communities has not been really articulated in many of these policies so far.
Tobias, the North Carolina A&T student who just finished his graduate degree, says he wants to help solve those equity problems, starting with students at his school.
A&T in downtown Greensboro, it's close but still far.
And it's not an easy walk. So for students who don't have cars, an autonomous shuttle could make it possible to commute to a job or just buy groceries off campus. In Greensboro, I'm Cole Del Charco for Marketplace.
On university campuses and in private labs all over the world, the pandemic led to an explosion of interest in biotech. A cooling economy has slowed that slightly, but the industry is still growing. Demand for lab space was at an all-time high in the Bay Area last year, and the industry is expected to expand its footprint by 30% this year. Leslie McClurg explains how researchers are applying the lessons they learned from COVID-19 to treat other diseases.
Along Oyster Point Road in South San Francisco, bulldozers clear industrial warehouses. Construction workers busily replace single-story factories with skyscrapers.
You can see the cranes, you can see the new construction going up.
Mark Pope works for Cushman & Wakefield, a commercial real estate company. He takes me on a tour through the area. He points to the headquarters of AstraZeneca, J-Labs, and 23andMe. What was once a neighborhood of cream-colored factories is now a glistening alley of biotech companies. The pandemic was very good for business.
It put the market on steroids.
Last year, investors spent nearly 3 times more than usual on the life sciences in California. South San Francisco projects these companies will double their footprint from 12 million square feet to 25 million square feet within the next few years. Lessons from the pandemic are spurring vitality in surprising sectors. Joe Panetta is the president and CEO of Biocom in California, a trade association for the life sciences.
Diagnostics for a long time was the poor stepsister of the biotech industry. You couldn't raise money for a diagnostic to save your life, literally.
But all those COVID rapid tests changed that. And companies want to get ahead of the next novel virus. So there's a lot of venture capital focused on infectious diseases.
Those new companies are not only growing themselves, but they're attractive to large multinational pharmaceutical and biotech and medical device companies.
Many of which are headquartered in the Bay Area. And then there's obviously the success of mRNA vaccines.
So this is where the magic happens.
Shanaz Suliman is the CEO of Recode Therapeutics. They just opened a lab.
What we're doing is building on all that great innovation from the vaccines to go beyond vaccines.
She's referring to how the company hopes to use the technology that was so successful in the COVID vaccines to cure other diseases. Pfizer and Moderna used mRNA, or genetic medicine, to trigger an immune response to combat COVID. At Recode, they plan to use mRNA to treat other respiratory diseases. Suliman points to a small handheld nebulizer that looks kind of like a flying saucer releasing a fine mist.
That allows the medication to be deposited in their airways and go directly into the cell types that we want to affect.
A patient can inhale the genetic medicine into the lungs, where the mRNA will hopefully correct the protein that causes cystic fibrosis. Instead of shots, every few days, patients can use the nebulizer to keep their disease in check. Suliman says mRNA technology could eventually target numerous diseases that have stumped researchers for years.
Imagine the possibilities if you could undo a gene that was responsible for Alzheimer's. Imagine the possibilities if you could get into a tumor cell because you were able to deliver a genetic medicine directly into the cell that was responsible for that cancer.
Her list goes on and on. Even though daily headlines continue to warn Americans of a pending recession, Recode has raised $200 million in venture capital funding. They have nearly doubled their staff since January, and that's a trend across the sector. In San Francisco, I'm Leslie McClurg for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, courtesy of the Washington Post. With the new year will come a boost in Social Security payments for those eligible. Thank you, inflation, I guess. But the Post found thousands of people every year are denied Social Security disability benefits because courts that determine whether someone can still work are relying on job lists from the 1970s, and many of those jobs don't even really exist anymore. For example, one disabled man in the story was told he should still be able to work as a dowel inspector, an egg processor, or a nut sorter. Here's your moment of economic context. One of the many, many things packed into that 4,000-page spending bill is a change that could kick millions of people off state Medicaid programs. During the COVID-19 health emergency, many states suspended eligibility verifications for the program, which provides health care for low-income people. Under the new rules, states will be able to restart those verifications in April, which, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation, could threaten coverage for 5 to 14 million people. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Dylan Mietinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Ellen Rolfes, Virginia K. Smith, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the executive director, and I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.